Let me tell you something about my vehicle. My vehicle has over 320,000 miles on it, and it's still going strong, fires right up. Except in the wintertime. It doesn't really fire right up in the wintertime. But it's a fucking black hole, man. You ever had a dryer or an appliance that stole your socks or forks or something like that? That's how my truck is, except it's a lot worse. I lost a one-hitter, which is a cigarette-shaped pipe for marijuana designed to hit one marijuana at a time. I lost that in my truck one day at my job. I'm sure it's in my truck. I did not drop it on the ground. I saw that I put it in the cup holder, and I heard it fell as I pulled off. That was a year ago. I've actually hope to get pulled over so that I can have the cops help me look for my pipe, but I have since replaced the pipe. Into the gnomes that took my pipe, I'll see you in hell. Today is Tuesday, October the 16th, and this is the official second season reboot episode. Officially, this episode. I might say it in other episodes because I recorded them at a different time, but this is the actual one because this is the one that you're hearing. Anyway, we're back with new interesting guests, new topics, a ton of cool shit that we're going to do on the show. We're going to, you know, I'll tell you one thing. We're going to do a drug on the show or two or a few, whatever. We got a sponsor now, streetfur.com. If you need any kind of gear, cool designs, that's where you need to go. Streetfur.com is the place. We don't have a promo code set up yet. We've got to do that. But you're going to be able to go and type in nowcast at streetfur.com and get 10% off of a item, which is super cool. The designs are dope as fuck. The materials the clothes are made out of is A1. That means it's super fucking good. And, you know, it supports the Here and Nowcast podcast. Another way you can support the Here and Nowcast podcast is by donating to our page on Anchor. I'm not sure how they distribute the donation box, but if you go to the main home of the Here and Nowcast podcast, which is anchor.fm, you will find a box where you can donate to the show, and all proceeds go towards promotion for the show, as well as getting me to more interesting guests so I don't have to, you know, do it over Skype and it sounds less good, you know. Anyway. Yeah, so that's the whole gist of this intro. I'm not going to keep you for too long, but you already know what we got to do. The Here and Nowcast podcast drug tip of the week. And with the guest that we have today, it is only right that the Here and Nowcast podcast drug tip of the week be always test your drugs. No matter what the drug is, test your MDMA, test your LSD. Test your 4-ACO-DMT if you're into research chemicals. Always, always, always test, and don't go by the word of whoever sold it to you or the people around you, because you just don't know. And honestly, one of the biggest problems with the drug war is the lack of harm reduction out there. So we all need to practice harm reduction, not only so we be, here we go, it's gonna be a long episode. Not only so we're more aware of the substances we put in our body, how to take them, how to test them, but just so we live, you know? You don't want to die, do you? You don't want other people to die. Look at all these ODs. You want this shit to stop, don't you? Unless you're some kind of asshole. Are you an asshole? I didn't think so. So, you know, do yourself a favor. Test your drugs. Be super smart about what you put in your body. And with that being said, I bring you the founder of DanceSafe, the founder of Ecstasy Data, and the creator of MDMA the Movie, Emmanuel Sferios. I'd like to say welcome to the Here and Nowcast podcast. I honestly couldn't think of a more relevant person to have at the moment here, the founder of DanceSafe and Ecstasy Data. This is absolutely wonderful to have you on the show. So welcome, and
thank
we're glad
you
to have you a part of the podcast.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks very much. I also said I listened to one of your previous episodes and I loved it. You know, I've been thinking about starting a drug podcast network where we, you know, get a website and then we all agree to kind of promote each other to kind of build up kind of a drug positive podcast network. Because, you know, you're doing great stuff too, helping destigmatize drugs. You know, I have all these big visions a lot of times. It's going to take me a while to really get it going, but I'll definitely be contacting you when I decide to start that.
That sounds great. This is my absolute dream. I actually first encountered you on the social media networks, which was Reddit. You were saying that you wanted to be a part of Joe Rogan's podcast, and Joe Rogan is actually the reason why I started my podcast.
Oh, okay, great.
So thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, I haven't listened to a full episode of Joe Rogan, to be honest. It's just everyone kept telling me, you got to get on Joe Rogan's show. You got to, you know, and I emailed him, you know, a year or two ago and never heard anything back. So I decided, well, why don't, you know, everyone keeps telling me this. Let's get a bunch of people to write to him and say, hey, have Dan Safe Founder on your podcast. The thing, you know, was strange to me. Like, I posted it on my Facebook page and got this huge positive response. Probably a couple dozen of my friends and fans said, oh, that'd be great. We'd love to have you on the show. And they emailed Joe Rogan and all that. But there's a lot of trolls on Reddit. There are a lot of people that were just like insulting and say, who are you? Why do you think? They didn't even bother Googling me, you know? And they said, well, why are you spamming Joe Rogan? And I'm like, that's not spam. I'm just like giving a suggestion.
Exactly. It's not all necessarily about who you know. I mean, sometimes we got to lift each other up and support each other to get them into the spotlight to be seen by someone as big as Rogan.
Right. Right. Well, you know, I was on Duncan Trussell's show and I'm going on again next month and they're friends. So maybe Duncan can put a word in for me.
Yeah, Duncan, I'm a huge, huge fan of Duncan as well. I was actually just recently trying to contact him with all I'm going through with my mom and stuff. And when he lost his mom, he was podcasting about it a lot and stuff. And a lot of the things that he was saying was really resonating with me while I was going through and still going through it. And I was just trying to reach out to him to tell him, hey, I'm in the Dead Moms Club now, too. And I'm an even stronger listener to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. But yeah, I didn't, of course, get a response back, but still, yeah. I was just trying to reach out to the guy.
Yeah, and you just reminded me. I'm sorry, I forgot. My condolences to you because, you know, you were going to interview me a couple weeks ago, and then you emailed saying your mom just passed away. So deep, deep condolences for you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much. It really helps a lot. It was actually pretty crazy. The morning, it was Wednesday, the 17th, I believe. And that morning I had just emailed you and we were going to set it up. And I told you I was on my way to the office right then. And that same day, I got a phone call from a police officer and he was telling me to come to my mom's house because she had collapsed. And I'm driving home and I'm like, well, why are they telling me to come to her house? Why aren't they telling me to come to the hospital? So right at that moment, I started to kind of consider alternative realities and what might actually be going on. And sure enough, when I got to her house, those were the circumstances. And I've just been dealing with that since then. And
was it sudden? Was she ill? What did she die
from?
Well,
my mom's been terminally ill since I was a younger lad. She suffered from terminal kidney disease, but she actually ended up getting a kidney transplant, I believe, around 2009 or 2010, maybe. It could be a little later. I'm not exactly sure. But the second kidney that she got ended up failing as well, which it put her back on dialysis. It put her back through the rounds. And just over the past few years, she's been in and out of the hospital. It's been crazy since then, but I'm getting by all right. I feel like as best as a person can get by in a situation like this. I'm only 23. I'll be 24 this month.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, my father passed away in 2012. So what's that, 6 years ago? But, you know, I'm 49. 23 is pretty young to have a parent die. Really sorry to hear about that.
Her funeral was 2 days ago. And the night before that, I ingested a dose of psilocybin to kind of help me through that. I did some serious coping that night and had some realizations about that. And one of the main things I realized was my mom's finally where every parent wants to be, which is on their kid's mind 24/7. So
did you have a sitter with you to talk about things, or were you alone?
I was alone for the most part. My spouse was at the house with me, but she pretty much understood that I was doing it for a certain reason. So I went into the room, put on some headphones, and kind of let the music guide me through my realizations and my meeting with the angel of death, which is what I'll call it. The angel of death brings wisdom.
Right.
Brings wisdom. So I definitely got a lot of that night. But, yeah, it's been interesting.
Great. Yeah.
But, for the people who don't know, how about you kind of just tell them what exactly it is you do? What is your mission?
My main mission is to end the drug war. I've been an activist for a long time, and I think the drug war is one of the most evil policies that we have in this country. The corruption that has resulted from it, the erosion of our civil rights and the Constitution, the no-knock raids with battering rams busting people's doors down, the prison industrial complex, the new slavery where African-American communities are targeted way more heavily and now work in prison industries for $1 an hour. Endless. Right. The 200,000 people who have died in Mexico over the last decade from drug war violence, and the fact that we can't use these healing medicines. All of this, it's just, if we ended the drug war, our society would be a much better place.
Absolutely.
But, you know, that's from the very beginning. That's largely why I started DanceSafe, even. But DanceSafe is a nonprofit harm reduction organization that provides truthful, non-judgmental drug safety information and services to drug users, mostly in the electronic dance music community. But, you know, we also sell fentanyl testing strips on our website and try not to make distinctions at all between different types of drug users. You know, I'm a psychedelic user, but I don't judge people that use other drugs. We got to remember that the vast majority of drug use is non-problematic, completely and totally, and that even includes the drugs we think of as the most dangerous, heroin and cocaine and meth. Most people who use them are infrequent, casual users, and they're not having any negative repercussions on society. So knowing that, we can really help people understand why it's not going to be the end of the world, cause chaos, if we were to decriminalize and legally regulate these substances. In fact, Portugal did it 15 years ago, and they reduced overdose deaths by 50% just by legalizing the personal possession of drugs. That's called decriminalization. It's different from full legalization. It's still illegal to make and sell them, but once you make it no longer a crime to possess drugs for personal consumption, you open up the public conversation. Now people can talk to each other without fear. They can talk to their doctors, teachers, police even, and service providers, harm reduction and counseling people. It just makes things so much better, and it has actually reduced overall drug use, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And more importantly, it's reduced fatalities.
That's beautiful. I was actually watching a video of you giving a talk, and I saw a good amount of law enforcement officers there. And just seeing them there supporting what you had to say was a very wonderful thing to see. I have conversations with cops sometimes. I hang out around I skateboard, and I like to film people doing things. So I like to hang out at parks, and I talk to the state park officers and things like that. And it seems like a lot of them, they're ready for the drug war to end. They're ready to stop, you know, wasting their time on people who aren't hurting the environment or other people. Go ahead.
I think you're right about that. I think local cops, way more than the feds, understand the drug war is not working. I mean, the number one reason that people hate cops is because they're out to bust you for drugs. I remember getting pulled over for minor traffic violations when I first learned to drive in Florida twice. You know, I was 16, 17, and both times, the first thing the officer said to me, flashlight in the window, been smoking any dope. And wow. I wasn't a pod smoker. I still don't like cannabis. That's another story, though. I like almost all the other drugs, but cannabis makes me insane. Anyway, I learned real quick the cops were not there to protect me. They were out to get me. And I always I became paranoid whenever a cop pulled me over, you know? So that I think they get that it's most local cops that the drug war is bad for them. But the federal government's so disconnected from reality, especially now with Trump and Sessions in power, it's been a battle, right? But we're winning that battle. States have legalized some form of cannabis, medical or recreational, in over half, and I think 28 states, and there's more on the ballot right now. But yet the feds still aren't budging around it. And local jurisdictions are trying to pass safe injection facilities now. San Francisco almost did it, but just last week, earlier this week, Jerry Brown vetoed it. So, you know, it's a long process, but I think we're winning. I really think we're going to see decriminalization within my lifetime. Both sides of the political aisle support it. Republicans and a majority of Republicans and Democrats support decriminalization. It's just about pressuring our politicians to do what their constituents want.
Right, and getting the lobbyists to comply without letting them regulate certain things and try to patent certain things, because a lot of lobbyists actually protest against legalization because it hurts their sales. Let me see here. I was going to ask you something here. Do you think that blanket bans on substances like the new bill that they're trying to pass, the CITSA Act, the CITSA, it's a blanket ban in an attempt to stop the fentanyl epidemic. And there's also another bill I just heard about where they're trying to more closely monitor the mail system to track for fentanyl. Do you think that blanket bans and new bills that are, that are after one thing and kind of grab up all the other things with it, do you think those help the drug war or hurt the drug war?
We are not going to enforce our way out of this problem. All the laws that we've passed already, all the money that we've put in to try to stop people from using substances has not worked. It's only generated a larger market in drugs. The issue with the fentanyls is the same thing as the issue with K2 or spice, the synthetic cannabinoids. Right. The only reason that people use these things is because cannabis is illegal. The only reason that fentanyl is being put into heroin is because there is no safe, legal way for people who are daily heroin users to get get heroin. Now, we got to make a distinction here. People always ask me, what are you saying, that heroin should be as available as cannabis? And no, every drug's got to be regulated differently. Cannabis is the only drug – well, no, it's not true. Let me say that differently. Nobody's ever died from cannabis. No one's ever died from LSD or from psilocybin either. But the many people have died from heroin. And so nobody wants heroin available in 7-Elevens. So the solution to the opioid crisis is heroin-assisted treatment. And Switzerland has done this. Germany – there is a little bit of it being done in Canada right now. And basically what that means is that if you find yourself hooked on, you can then go to a government clinic and enter a program where they'll give you pure heroin up to 3 times a day. And you have to stay a half an hour to make sure you don't overdose. And this has served two very important purposes. Number one is it helps the heroin user get off the street, stop having to spend all their money on drugs, commit crimes to get money to buy their drugs. Right. And then they get back on their feet and get a job, put food in the fridge for their kids. It improves their self-esteem. And they found that people that have been in this program in Switzerland for a couple of years, half of them end up quitting for good. And that is an astounding statistic, because no treatment program ever anywhere in existence has a success rate greater than 5%. What that means is that treatment simply doesn't work. And that whatever it is, if it's 12-step programs, if it's going to jail, where you're forced to detox, people get out of jail, and then they start right back up again. But about 5% of people that get themselves addicted, at some point, they decide on their own, all right, I've had enough with this. But yet, if you just take away any pretense of treatment, you take away the stigma, the judgment that's telling people you've got to stop, and you just give them their heroin, 50% end up quitting. That's an order of magnitude greater than any treatment program that we know of. And you know what? You would never even know these people were on heroin, because when you've been on a daily heroin for a long time, you're not getting high anymore. You're just feeling normal.
Yeah, you're just getting by.
The inebriation or the euphoria is almost a side effect of opiates. Once you've been on them long enough, that goes away. So this notion that addicts are just they're like hedonists trying to get high and escape reality, very well could be the fact that opiates are the best medicine that we have for severe childhood trauma, and that what's really going on is these people are trying to medicate for their psychological pain. And once you get past that 2-3 week period where you have this euphoria and it's harder to function, now you're just normal. We really need to rethink heroin and opiates. If we stopped judging the drug and the people who did it, we could implement these maintenance programs and help a lot of people. But the second thing about heroin maintenance programs, and this is the real reason that Switzerland implemented them, is that if you remove all of the addicts from the heroin market, it puts dealers out of business. You reduce demand, exactly. And there's less heroin around for other people to get themselves addicted to.
We're seeing the same thing with cannabis right now. All of the legal marijuana that's available is forcing dealers out of the market or to go straight.
That's right. That's right. Well, I'd like to say cannabis, you know, it should be free. There's no drug that produces as much crop per acre as cannabis does. You can grow one plant and have enough weed for you and your friends and family for an entire year. So why would you spend any money on it? Cannabis should be cheaper than tomatoes. And it's a weed. I call it a weed for a reason, right? So yeah. The only reason that cannabis is expensive is because people are in jail. The only reason that cannabis costs any money at all is because there's a risk cost in growing it and dealing it, that you're paying a lot of money because people are having to spend a lot of money to implement security so that they don't get busted growing it or dealing it, right? Prohibition creates the cost. So if you remove prohibition, it becomes free. We're not going to do that with heroin. With heroin, it's going to have to be these centers I'm talking about, a very strict form of regulation. But by providing people who are addicted to it with a way to get it, it's similarly going to put all the illegal dealers out of business.
What do you think is stopping the progression of these heroin use clinics, because it seems like the solution is sort of just giving everybody what they want? We can give the pharmaceutical companies and the government the money they want for regulating it, and the centers could, you know, maybe charge like $5 for you to get in or something like that. So they sort of get what they want on the governmental side, and the users get what they want, which is a safe, clean environment to come in and do what they need to do and to get back into society. So what do you think is stopping this progression from happening?
The most important question. Thank you for asking it. Two things. Number one is public attitudes that judge drug users and the drug. It's basically misinformation. We think the drug is so evil, we don't understand it, and we scapegoat people who use it. I'll elaborate a bit on this, right? I interviewed Gabor Mate, who wrote a great book on addiction called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. He's an addiction treatment counselor in Vancouver, Canada. And during my interview, he told me about the scapegoating process with drugs. We all, he said, feel a little guilt and shame over our consumption habits. We live in a culture that tells us to gratify our desires instantly, constantly, right? Consumer culture. We're bombarded with advertisements right away. You want this, buy now, blah, blah, blah. And people have shopping addictions. They have sex addictions, gambling addictions, food addictions, probably the biggest addiction of all. And everyone feels a little guilty about that. We all do. We're not our best selves. And here's the kicker. What he said is that shame is the greatest motivation of human behavior. And so in order to relieve ourselves of our shame, to make ourselves feel better about ourselves, we take everything that we don't like in ourselves and we project it in an exaggerated false belief onto one segment of the population. In this case, it's the addict or the drug user. We say, at least I'm not like them. And then we support and validate all these horrible policies that put them in jail. That's what classic scapegoating is. Jesus talked about it, right? Religions have referred to this. It's a very difficult thing to get over. It requires healing. It requires a type of enlightenment on the individual, which is why I think psychedelic therapy and MDMA for PTSD can be really helpful in ending the drug war, because I think a lot of scapegoating happens from unresolved trauma. And once we start liking ourselves more, we're not going to engage in that process.
And that's where you come in. That's why pioneers like you are so important to get people in the mode to change that attitude, to feel better about themselves, to destigmatize, to undemonize these things so that people are finally comfortable enough with themselves to progress into a new mode of thinking. That's exactly right. Wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, you get it. Yep, that's exactly right.
I totally get it.
But there's no number two here. This might even be a harder hurdle to get by. And number two, reason that we're not the greatest challenge for legalizing drugs is that there are billions of dollars made, untaxable dollars, in drug sales, and the corruption is rampant. Drugs, and let's be clear. I'm talking mostly, almost exclusively, about heroin and cocaine. Heroin and cocaine together are number two in international commerce. Number one is oil. Number three is weapons. There is more money traded in heroin and cocaine than there is in armaments around the world. Think about that for a second.
Wow.
Who controls those money flows? Massive cartels, the intelligence agencies around the world that get kickbacks in protecting the production and distribution of these drugs. What do you think the U.S. military is doing in Afghanistan how many years has it been now? 15 years?
Yeah, 15.
90% of the heroin in the world, it begins in the poppy fields of Afghanistan. And we've been occupying that country for this long and we can't stop it. Our military is there protecting the flow of drug money. They want to make sure it flows into Western corporations, because that's where all this money gets laundered. People think of the mom and pop pizza shop in the Bronx that's laundering drug money. That is a drop in the bucket compared to how the cartels clean their money through multinational corporations. In fact, HSBC, the largest bank in Europe, got busted for laundering drug money. They actually built cash drop boxes to the specifications of the cartels, because the cartels couldn't fit their garbage bags full of cash into the normal cash box. So they constructed larger, you know, like ATM cash boxes on the side of their banks just so the cartels could be able to deposit their money. They got busted. They got a slap on the wrist and a small fine, right? Because these financial corporations rule all the politicians. So this corruption is really the biggest problem. But wow. And I, you know, I don't know how we can work on that. That's a really hard one. And I'm not sure when we'll ever, you know, in my lifetime, see the legalization of heroin and cocaine in these ways that we're talking about, heroin maintenance programs, et cetera. But they're not making this kind of money off of psychedelics. And so I think in my lifetime we may see the legalization, meaning safe legal access and regulation of psychedelics. I do think, like I said before, that we might see decriminalization happen in my lifetime, including for heroin and cocaine, because that doesn't disrupt the money flows. That just helps keep people alive by creating an environment where harm reduction can thrive.
Right. Wow, that's so interesting. I didn't know that it ran that deep with the heroin and the cocaine. And that is definitely a big problem. And I can't think of a way myself, at least right now, that we can solve that. Let's talk MDMA the movie.
All right.
That's definitely very interesting. So what's going on with that?
Yeah. So I've been working on a documentary about MDMA for the past 5 years now. And, you know, I think big. So I really have hopes that we can win awards at film festivals and that this can be, you know, a major documentary. And so it's got a budget of about $500,000. I've raised about half of that and spent about half of it. And now we're at the point we're entering post-production. But that costs as much money as production, right? The editing, the music, the archive, getting the archival materials, the animation and motion graphics, all that. So so we're still fundraising. People can go to MDMAthemovie.com, and we've got an ongoing crowdfunding campaign there. We're also seeking investors. The film, though, is actually going to be about more than just MDMA. It's going to be a lot about the things that we're talking about here. It's really a drug policy reform documentary that centers around MDMA because I believe MDMA, in helping resolve childhood trauma, can really help end the scapegoating process that drives the drug war. So MDMA, again, to me, is the drug to end the drug war. And so we're going to talk about all of this. It's a drug policy reform film.
Right.
And part of it is a veteran story. We follow around two Iraq veterans who have healed themselves through the use of MDMA therapy. And because fundraising was going slow and this footage was amazing, I decided to release a short documentary, which I've already done. It's on YouTube. And it's the full veteran story, a very small amount of which is going to appear in the main documentary. It's about a half an hour long, and it's called Dead Dog on the Left. Dead Dog on the Left is a phrase from the documentary where these two veterans are talking with each other about their experiences in Iraq, and one of them says, "Remember that time when we were out on patrol and you shout out, 'Dead dog on the left'?" And the other one says, "Yeah, I thought there was a bomb in it from everything I was told." I actually had a veteran email me after watching it saying, "Wow, man, as soon as I heard the title of the film, I knew exactly what that was talking about, because all of the vets over there get trained. Watch out for dead animals, because the insurgency often puts bombs in it."
So yeah, they put the – yeah.
This was a scene where – and it was the only time that one of the veterans laughs, because he's really suffering from his PTSD. We follow him through his therapy, and it really worked for him. So it's in the end, it's a very positive story. But you really feel for him in this scene. It's the only time he laughs, but he's laughing, talking about like this fear that they had while they were over there. So that's why I chose the name. And go check it out. It's on
YouTube. Oh yeah, definitely. We'll post the links. We'll do all of that. Dead Dog on the Left. That sounds. I've been watching things like that. I'm actually really into MDMA, although I've never actually tried it before.
Oh really?
Yeah, I'm a psychedelic person myself, and throughout my psychedelic career, I've been sort of afraid to kind of mess up my track record as far as the way my body deals with the psychedelics, and I've always been sort of afraid of the MDMA come down. But yeah. As I've learned more over the years, I've sort of realized that it's all about, you know, harm reduction. It's all about how you use it. And I've been more and more willing to try MDMA. So maybe with all that's going on right now, in the near future, I'll actually give it a try.
Good. I just say follow all the rules. Listen to the people that have come before you, you know, go to the Dance Safe site, look at them, go to the MAP site, you correct dose, test it first, make sure you got pure material, make sure you got a milligram scale so you can weigh it, you know, do 100 milligrams the first time that you're doing it. Definitely don't go higher than 125 the first time. And yeah, most people do not experience harsh come downs. I would say it's a significant minority, maybe about 30%. And it might be a day or two. It might last a day or two. I mean, if you're using it every week and you're vulnerable to depression, then that could really exacerbate your symptoms.
I have a close family member who abused MDMA daily for about 6 months.
I've heard this story from people, and I've talked to a lot of people who've made similar claims, and I'm very skeptical about it. I think that they were probably getting a cathinone, like methylone, or maybe meth or straight amphetamine. But the thing about MDMA is it won't work if you try to take it every day. Nobody can use real MDMA every day. You just can't.
What's your take on these UK kids who are taking these 500 milligram MDMA presses every weekend and still being able to function on some level? Do you think that that's completely legitimate, or do you think that there's some smoke and mirrors to that? Because some of those presses make it over to the States, and they get tested, and they're really, really strong.
Yeah. So I don't know if I've heard of 500, but I think it's been close to 400, 375. Those pills, the people putting them out put scores in them and claim that, you're supposed to break them in half or whatever. But a lot of people don't know that. And it's very dangerous. I wish, that MDMA was regulated so that all pills would be 100 milligrams. Everyone would know exactly what they were getting. But the British use the most MDMA in a given session of every country in the world. The drug policy, the global drug survey showed that. They asked people, if you know how many milligrams you take in a given session, how much is it? And the average in Britain was like 400 milligrams per session. Doesn't mean they take it all at once, but through a given night, they'll take 400 milligrams. And Germany was the lowest. Germany was like 130 was average, And so there's a lot of pushing limits in the UK. They're the same with alcohol, too. They really get wasted when they drink. And I think it's the Protestant anti-pleasure culture over there that they're so pent up that when they do go out to party, they overdo it. They don't have a way to moderate.
That makes sense.
But I think it's probably true that you can – get by for a while taking MDMA every weekend, even high doses like that. But it always ends up catching up to you eventually. Even if you don't suffer from the post-MDMA depression, you're going to start building up a tolerance where you're not going to be able to feel MDMA anymore. It's a permanent tolerance is unique to MDMA. We're not talking short-term tolerance where you just need your receptors to reset themselves, or with MDMA you need to wait until your brain replenishes its serotonin before you can release more of it, because that's what MDMA does. It just releases the stored serotonin that's already in your serotonin axons. That serotonin is built from tryptophan containing proteins. Turkey, meats, cheeses, a lot of proteins that we eat contain tryptophan. It's an amino acid, and then your body starts combining it and eventually creates serotonin. But our serotonin was never meant to be released all at once. We didn't evolve to have pour it all out at once. So MDMA does that, and then the process takes a while before you can replenish those stores. I say maybe a week or two, depending on genetics and diet. And so weekly use is probably the heaviest that we really see. And I think what you're saying is probably true. People can get away with that for a while, but eventually it's gonna catch up to them.
Right. That's what I try to tell people a lot. I actually had a job at a warehouse last year. Well, actually, at the beginning of 2018 was when I left that to go to another place. But toward the end of my stay there, there was some supposed MDMA going around. And I never actually knew how connected, your line of work was to my life, because I actually keep reagents. I practice heavy harm reduction. I'm the drug nerd of my group of friends. Everybody comes to me for information and to get their stuff tested, even though I don't take MDMA myself. I love testing people's MDMA and telling them what's in it. But for about 2 weeks at this warehouse job, everyone was taking this supposed MDMA. It was all coming from one person. And so I decided to get a sample of it, and I tested it, and it was pure methamphetamine. And everyone up there was buying more and more and more. And some one of the people who worked at the warehouse with me went over to the next job with me. And they were addicted to it. They were full on addicted. They didn't know what was going on. I tested it. I told them what was in it. And they were, to say the least, they were stunned. Angry.
That's really interesting. But that shows, it's very interesting. What that shows is that the cultural perception, the name of the drug you're doing carries a lot of weight. When they thought they were taking MDMA, because MDMA is the good drug and there's so much positive things about it, they had a positive association with what they were doing. As soon as they discovered it was meth, oh my God, now they're worried. Now, you know, they're alarmed and they're not going to get the social kudos for saying to their friends, yeah, I've been using meth every day.
Exactly. And
this is one of the reasons why I think so many people have told me and claimed that they are addicted to MDMA. But again, that is impossible for that to happen. They're not going to feel good if you take MDMA 2 days in a row, especially not 3 days in a row. Once you release all that serotonin, taking more of serotonin releaser is just going to make you feel like crap. So
yeah, when someone looks at me and goes, oh yeah, I've been up for 3 days, I just want to do more MDMA, I'm like, look, man, you might have a problem here. You really need to invest in a test kit.
Right.
But yeah, little do these people know, which it's interesting what you just said, because little do they know the chemical structure of MDMA is similar to methamphetamine in the last two letters of the acronym for MDMA is methamphetamine.
Right. But that's a little deceptive because the drugs work on completely different neurotransmitter systems. You know, the FDA has just released the generic name for MDMA, right? MAPS studies have been happening, and it's going to be legalized in a couple of years for the treatment of PTSD. And so the FDA creates a generic name, and MAPS was a little bit upset. I don't like it either. The name that they've given for MDMA is mitomethamphetamine. And MAPS didn't like it, particularly because it has phetamine in the name, and it's going to make people think that it's amphetamine. But other amphetamines, all the amphetamines that we know of, work on dopamine. Meth, you know, dextroamphetamine, et cetera, these bind to the dopamine reuptake transporter, causing it to release dopamine. MDMA does not. MDMA binds to the serotonin reuptake transporter, causing it to release serotonin. And MDMA is more produces a feeling more of relaxation than stimulation. It keeps you awake and alert while you're relaxed, and that's what makes it such a good therapy drug, because other anti-anxiety drugs that we like Valium and Xanax, they'll take away your anxiety, but they also numb you out. So it's not effective to have a therapy process. But MDMA really relaxes you while also makes you very lucid and very aware. And it's perfect for engaging in therapeutic discussions about your relationships or about past trauma, where normally you're going to have a panic attack or freak out, right? So it's actually produces a very different experience than an amphetamine does.
How do you feel about MDA as far as treatment for something like PTSD, despite the fact that it might be more neurotoxic? Do you think it could be just as useful?
I like MDA. To me, I think it's a much more just a recreational experience than a therapeutic experience. But I don't knock any of the psychedelics for their therapeutic potential. I think MDA certainly has some. It certainly was used that way, a lot of reports. But when MDMA came out, it just kind of blew away MDA in terms of its Purdue University chemist came up with for MDMA. It means touching within from the Latin. And MDA was never called an entactogen. It was just another hallucinogen that happened to have a slightly emotional component. I would say MDMA has 5 to 10 times more of an emotional component as MDA does. MDA also has a slight visual effect that MDMA does not have.
Okay. One last question before we wrap it up. I got to head into the office here pretty soon. All right. How do you feel the scene, the rave scene and just the drug scene has changed, whether that be for the better or worse, with the emergence of, you know, harm reduction in such a high volume from the internet? How do you feel like that's impacted the scene? Do you see changes that are good or bad? Yeah.
Oh, it's been absolutely incredibly positive. Prior to the internet, it was virtually impossible for young people to get truthful information about drugs, right? Teachers won't tell you the truth. Government's not telling you the truth. Parents, if they, you know, often don't, even if they knew. So the internet allowed for people who use drugs to actually come together and talk honestly, and the truth rises to the top. If you're smart enough, you go to Arrowhead, you go to DanceSafe, you go to Blue Light, Drugs Forum. You go to these places, and you can really find out the truth. And the truth allows people to use more safely, be more responsible. When I first started DanceSafe, the internet had just come out, and a lot of people still hadn't, young people especially, hadn't found those sites, and the level of ignorance and misuse and abuse was far greater. I'm speaking mostly about the psychedelic culture, the party drug culture, which even includes people who use cocaine on the weekends. I think that with opiates and addiction, it's a very different animal, not really a community I have been a part of, in terms of people that are casual recreational users, I think that the internet and harm reduction services like DanceSafe have made an immense improvement in public health.
That was actually how I first started my, you know, psychonautic journey, which was going through DanceSafe and Arrowhead. And you started DanceSafe in 96, didn't you?
Actually, it was 98, but it was just called the Ecstasy Harm Reduction Project. We didn't come up with the name DanceSafe until the beginning of 99.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, I was probably around, I want to say, 16 years old when I first started to educate myself about substance use and those types of things. And I did a lot of research before I jumped into it. But, yeah, I use those resources extensively, and they're such great tools to use, and I hope other people use them. But it's been really amazing having you on the show. Definitely want to keep in contact with you. You've informed me on some things that I had no idea. I thought that I was completely, you know, informed on the drug war and things like that, but I definitely have some things that I need to research. But it was great having you.
Yeah, thanks. Let me know when there's a link. I'll promote the show.
Awesome. All right. All right, see you later, man.
Bye.
There you have it. That was it. That was hella fun to record. Super duper fun to do. So much information. I gotta re-listen to it and absorb it in. I recommend you do the same. Don't forget to donate to the Here Now Cast podcast, as well as go to streetfur.com. That's streetfurr.com. Get yourself a warm shirt because it's getting cold out here in the Midwest. I don't know where you are out there, but I don't like chafed nipples from the cold. I just don't like the shit, and I bet you don't like it either. So, MDMA the movie, go see that as soon as possible. Follow Emmanuel Sferios on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook, wherever you can find him. Go watch as many videos as you can on him as possible, because this guy is a treasure trove of knowledge. That's the show. You all have a nice rest of your day. I'm going to spark up this blunt and get back to my regularly scheduled nothingness.
Cada noche a mí me gusta reír, pues con mi baby ya nada me hace sufrir. Entre tus brazos siento